Proponents of large-scale learning have boldly promised that technology can disrupt traditional approaches to schooling, radically accelerating learning and democratizing education. In the new book, Failure to Disrupt: Why Technology Alone Can Transform Education, Justin Reich delivers a sobering report card on the latest supposedly transformative educational technologies, taking readers on a tour of autograders, computerized intelligent tutors, and other educational technologies whose problems and paradoxes have bedeviled educators. Technology does have a crucial role to play in the future of education, Reich concludes. We still need new teaching tools, and classroom experimentation should be encouraged, but successful reform efforts will focus on incremental improvements, not the next new killer app. We welcome Justin Reich to the roundtable this morning. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me today.
Am I right in pronouncing your last name Reich?
Hard K, Reich. The original German immigrants.
Okay, not like the former Treasury Secretary.
Okay. Softened in World War I and World War II due to anti-German sentiment.
Justin Reich, good morning. How are you?
I'm great.
All right. So tell us about the impetus. What brought you to want to talk about this failure to disrupt?
Well, over the last 10 years, education technology evangelists have made some really bold claims about how technology was going to transform education systems. The late Craig Christensen, who is a Harvard Business School professor famous for the theory of disruptive innovation, said that he wrote in 2009 that by 2019, half of all 6 through 12 classes would be taught online or in a blended way, that they'd cost one-third as much to provision, and they would be better than our current offerings. Sugata Mitra had a famous TED Talk which said we didn't even need schools at all, that kids could just teach themselves with laptops and connections to the Internet. And those claims are not only untrue, but they're sort of painfully untrue during the pandemic, as so many families are learning that online technology and education technology can't do everything that we hope that they can. So the book was written before the pandemic, but in some ways it tries to explain why things are so hard right now.
Well, right. So, I mean, when I was reading this, I'm like, oh, well, okay, now we're stuck with this, but we're doing everything wrong. Now what do we do?
Right. Yeah, it's actually quite hard to make improvements in educational systems in the midst of a pandemic. And so, you know, there are a few different ways to think about the challenge, though. The first is that schools are not institutions that can solve all of our social problems or pivot at a moment's notice. And so we need to make sure we're not asking schools to do things that they can't. You know, there are a bunch of folks who've said, like, schools need to make sure that kids are connected to the Internet and have technology. Well, like, your local superintendent is not going to be running fiber optic cable up the holler to connect, you know, rural homes to the Internet. That's a job for municipalities, for states, for the federal government. It's the job of the federal government, the states, to control the coronavirus so that we're not as dependent upon online learning. But moving forward, we need to recognize that technology is going to be increasingly a part of the way that schools operate. There are going to be more of these kinds of disruptions and pandemics as climate change accelerates. And so we need to invest in our schools, not just in purchasing technology for them, but in providing them with the opportunities for training, for professional development, for time together to figure out how to reinvent these new blended systems. And they aren't going to sort of sweep away the past. They're going to build on things we've done before. And our best bet is a steady, long-term effort at incremental improvement.
You write a lot in the book about massive open online courses, MOOC. Tell us why you begin there, and we'll often reference them as a comparison to other ways of educating.
Well, I think in 2012, you know, New York Times declared that it was the year of the MOOC, that there were these new courses which were having hundreds of thousands and eventually millions of people sign up for them. David Brooks and Thomas Friedman in the New York Times were writing op-eds about them. One of the founders of a MOOC organization, Sebastian Thrun, said that one day there'd be 10 universities left in the world, and these new MOOC providers might be one of them. And actually, these folks hired me. So I was hired by HarvardX in 2013 to be the first full-time research scientist studying them. So I have a sort of inside or outsider view. I was hired to study the enterprise, but I was also supervised by a bunch of academics who just wanted me to try to write what I saw and not necessarily advocate for any position. And, you know, MOOCs made a series of bold claims. They said they could radically reconfigure how higher education was organized, that we'd have, a few elite institutions that were producing these really high-quality, large-scale courses, and then local institutions would be basically sort of providing feedback and coaching in their local settings, that we would democratize education by creating new on-ramps for people into higher education, and that we would invent a new science of learning that was based on data. And basically, none of those things have come true, because technologies in education really don't lead to disruptive changes. What happened with MOOCs is that, for the most part, the most profitable niche for them ended up being supporting master's programs in technical subjects like business analytics and data science and computer science. And so they're helpful, but they're helpful in a very specific part of education for a relatively narrow group of people in particular kinds of circumstances. You know, they're good for people who are earning their second or third degree. And that's the way that we need to think about these tools, is not as things that are going to radically transform education, but as tools, as pegs that fit into specific holes into a complex system of education.
You make the point about halfway through the book, there's a chapter entitled The Curse of the Familiar, in which you start off with an example, but basically the point being that schools are conservative institutions in society. So all of these technological advances, how are they? Is it that culture? Is it that societal institutional thought that so often runs up against these ideas that causes the problem, or is it the technology itself?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily describe this conservatism of educational systems as a problem, but it is a feature. It's not surprising, perhaps, that we're conservative in how we educate young people.
Right.
But one of the challenges that we have is that new technologies, if they digitize existing practices at school, if they help people do things that they're already doing, they're much more likely to be adopted. One of the most widely adopted education technology tools in the U.S. is a service called Quizlet, which helps make digital flashcards. If you got a bunch of experts to sit around and say, what does the education system need more than anything else to move forward and improve? I don't think anyone would say, well, there's a real dearth of flashcards in America's schools, and this is an issue that needs to be addressed. But the reason why Quizlet is so successful is because everyone knows what flashcards are, and they know what to do with them, and this tool helps you do it a little bit more easily. By contrast, when we invent things that could really change the way teaching and learning happens, when we could reconfigure education in ways that might be more powerful, most teachers and students look at those kinds of technologies and go, oh, this is kind of confusing. I'm not sure exactly what this is supposed to do. Now, it is possible to introduce those tools into education systems, but these kinds of technologies are not like switches that you can flip on and off. They require support. They require opportunities for professional learning. One way to think about it is that every education technology solution is really a human capital problem. And so we have to think about not just introducing new technologies, but how we're going to change, iteratively evolve, incrementally improve these complex systems of education so that new technologies can be more useful and can lead to more powerful learning.
So what do we need when it comes to technology within this system, if you will? What is needed? What needs to come in that still has the values that we think of in education of access and equality and justice and rigor, dot, dot, dot?
Yeah, well, one challenge is that, you know, the K-12 system, the higher education system, is incredibly diverse. Somewhere today in the United States, you know, there's a seventh grade earth science teacher teaching the first lesson in a unit on plate tectonics to a group of students who are mostly immigrants. And somewhere else, there's a kindergarten teacher who's working in a special education pullout class. And somewhere else, there's a class of college freshmen who are entering their first writing seminar. all of those places require different kinds of technology. I do think that one thing that we've seen during the pandemic is that we probably need to stop thinking about broadband as a luxury good and to think of it more as a utility that's required for every household, just like
earlier, Justin,
in the 20th century.
I apologize.
Electricity that way.
I apologize because I asked you a question and I didn't look at the clock and I realized that I'm out of time. I am
no worries.
Very, very sorry. Justin Reich, the name of the book, Failure to Disrupt. Thank you very much for being with us.